It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Evan Lazar here, Patriots insider and host of the Patriots Beat podcast here on the CLNS Media Network. As always, our content is powered by our exclusive wagering partners, betonline.ag. Use the promo code CLNS50 for 50% off your welcome deposit. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts.
I'm Evan Lazar, joined as always by Alex Barth. And we are going to talk Patriots today because it is Patriots Beat, but I know the Celtics and Bruins are on everybody's mind. We're going to get to the Boston Sports Minute. Don't you worry about that. But we got to start with some Patriots. After all, this is a Patriots show. And we are now, roughly 2 weeks away from the first OTA practice of the offseason, the first time that you can actually pit offense versus defense on an NFL field. So now the players are in phase two. This is a strength and conditioning period, throwing against air, doing drills, passing drills against air, things like that. So we're starting to resemble real football a little bit, inching closer day by day. So today here on the show, we're going to talk about the Patriots offense. We're going to take you through the roster and the depth chart on the offensive side of the football, discuss some of the roster locks, discuss some of the position battles, what the future might hold for some of these guys that are on the bubble or maybe fighting for a roster spot. Next week, we'll move over to defense, and that's how we'll approach it the next couple of weeks. Obviously, the schedule release on Thursday as well, so we'll have a show to recap what's going on with the schedule on Thursday afternoon, which we should know with all the leaks and everything by the time we record the show. So, Alex, let's get right into it, and we'll talk here about this offense. I did this morning, handy dandy spreadsheet with the Patriots 90-man roster as it currently stands, has 87 players on it. This is the offensive part of that depth chart or that roster, and the players in yellow are players that I have highlighted as of right now as roster locks to make the team. And one of the things that when I went through this exercise, what was pretty remarkable is, based off of the 10-player draft class, the big free agent haul last offseason, there are not a whole lot of open roster spots on this team right now for some of the back end of the draft guys, some of the UDFAs, and even some of these veterans like a Ty Montgomery, for example, just looking at this list that signed this offseason. They're going to have to at least show out a little bit in training camp, I think, to make this roster.
Yeah, no, it's going to be, you're right, it's going to be a tight competition. This kind of reminds me of the 2020 team, right? Or was it 2019? We're coming in, there are like 80-something NFL caliber players. It's a little different. It's more about young talent. But yeah, there's going to be, guys will get hurt or whatever. But it's going to be kind of tight coming into camp. I think we already have a pretty generally good idea about what this roster looks like. I know people want to bemoan that they didn't add anybody this offseason. Well, they didn't really lose anybody either. Like they, in terms of like big names, they lost J.C. Jackson. In terms of the number of players they lost, just sheer numbers, it's not a significant number compared to what the average NFL team loses in an off season. I think they lost, I think it's 10, around 10 players from their 53-man roster last year. So yeah, it's going to be tight.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Evan, if you go in the top right there, you see that like little arrow under where it says share.
Yes.
If you hit that, it'll give you a little more space.
Yeah. So I just zoomed in a little bit. Hopefully people can see it a little bit better now.
I'm saying if you hit that arrow, it won't cut off the bottom of the offensive line column.
Oh, which arrow?
See where it says share on the spreadsheet?
Oh, I see. Yep.
There's a little arrow below that. If you hit that. No. Don't hit that.
I got you.
There you go.
There we go. Look at that.
Was Yadni Kajus the last one on the list? Does that give you everything?
I think so. I think there's one more. This is a deep offense. They have 16 offensive linemen on their roster right now. So when we get to offensive line, I'll just scroll down and we can get the whole picture of it. I could maybe zoom out a little bit. Now we're getting really into. All right, there we go. That should have the whole thing, as long as everybody can see it. If you can't see it, let me know, and we'll zoom back in. Anyways, I actually want to start with the wide receivers. I think there's a lot of things to talk about there with the quarterbacks as well, and obviously this whole depth chart. But I want to start with the wide receivers because we talked to Nelson Agholor today, and he had a big smile on his face, seems happy to still be in New England, and seems happy that this is where he's at. It does also sound like the workouts were something he organized down there in Florida, maybe taking on a little bit more of a leadership role in that room than we might have known or might have thought based off of last season. But that, to me, is one of the most interesting battles on this depth chart. They draft Tyquan Thornton. We know he's a lock as a second-round pick. They trade for Devontae Parker. We know he's a lock just because of investment, right? Third-round pick invested and all that kind of stuff. So Nelson Agholor, you talked me off of having him as a true lock here because it isn't, right? You know, they could trade him. They could move on from him at the end of training camp if Tyquan Thornton has a good camp. But I actually like the optics of having Thornton and Agholor on the roster at the same time. And I'll tell you why in a second. But I want to hear your take on what Nelson Agholor had to say today and what his future outlook is with the Patriots. Obviously, only under contract for more years, so it's just going to be this year most likely, no matter what.
Yeah, I mean, I like having those two speed guys. I think they kind of do different things on the field. I also think Thornton's still relatively raw, right? The reason I don't think Agholor is a lock is because if Thornton comes out and just blows up in camp and blows up in the preseason, then it's clear who the odd man out there is, right? I think if that's not the case, Thornton sort of becomes the odd man out to start the season, and maybe they put him more into the fold as the season goes on. So I think roster lock, like, here's how I judge a roster lock. And you're going to roll your eyes at this, but it's true. If somebody came up to me and said, should I buy this player's jersey today? Right? If the answer is not yes, the player's not a roster lock in terms of like investment. If somebody was like, should I buy a Nelson Agholor jersey today? I'd be like, maybe wait till the end of camp. Right? So I think there's a very, 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 very good chance he makes the team. I was a huge fan of everything he said today. I think he's got the right mindset for his situation, which it would be very easy for a guy like him to kind of check out right now. And he's clearly doing that. Instead, if anything, he's taking more of a leadership role. He talked about the opportunities that come with year two. I actually wrote a recap of what he said on 98.5thesportshub.com. You can go check that out. But I don't think by definition, he's not a roster lock, although I think there's a very good chance he makes the team.
Yeah, I think the fun thing about it with having him on the roster is they had Cooks and Philip Dorsett in 2017 on the team together. But other than that, since then, I would say that they could have two guys in Thornton and Agholor who can stretch a field vertically as well as both of those guys can, right? They usually have had one guy in that role. It's been a while since they've had two guys that can stretch the field like that. You start thinking about the idea of putting 11 personnel out there with Kendrick Bourne or Jacoby Myers inside, the tight end, Hunter Henry up the seam and over the middle of the field, the running back out of the backfield, and those two guys stretching the field and getting vertical, that's a pretty good amount of speed on the field. I don't know if the Patriots have had that kind of speed in a long time, probably since that 2017 season. You also throw in there that you could put Pierre Strong on the field with them too as a pass-catching back, and now we got some real 4-4 under speed out on the field. The Patriots are not a team that's had that kind of speed in at least 3 or 4 years.
I think you're really onto something here. The Dorsett thing to me at face value is an imperfect comparison, because remember, they traded for Philip Dorsett in September that year. They traded for him before week one. And at that point, Julian Edelman was out for the year. He tore his ACL. And what kind of happened was they basically said, well, if we're not going to have that element in our offense, let's be purely vertical. That really was a purely vertical offense, or as vertical as the Patriots ever were in the Tom Brady era. So if that's the comp you want to make, and I don't think you're wrong, but if that's the comp you want to make where it's going to be Aguilar, you know, they want Aguilar out there with maybe Thornton to add that speed, then I think that makes Jakobi Meyers the odd man out. And then I think it's Aguilar in the slot, right? Then I think Aguilar is your slot guy with Parker, Bourne, and Thornton rotating between the other two. And then it's really going to look like the 2017 offense because, again, they're going to get fully vertical. That's what, you know, if you want to go down that road, that's what that tells me. If they're trying to emulate 2017 with Dorsett and Aguilar, that's not a great sign for Jakobi Meyers in my mind, if that's the direction they're going to go.
Yeah. And if you look at the way that the Alabama offense ran itself with Mac Jones, obviously a big part of that was having Jalen Waddle and Devontae Smith, but they were a vertical based offense at Alabama. That was not a 5-yard pass offense, right? That was a down the field vertical shot making offense. This offense might not have that volume down the field just because they might be looking for guys like Thornton and Aguilar to clear out space for the guys to work underneath. So maybe that's more of the idea of it than necessarily pushing it down the field. But I love the idea of having Aguilar and Thornton both on the roster, not only because they can play together on the field, but then if Aguilar goes down, you have Thornton to back him up and vice versa. I love Devontae Parker's skill set. I think he's going to have a very specialized role, though. I don't know if he's going to necessarily be a full-time player unless he can really get back to who he was in 2019. We might be looking at more early down packages where they use those bigger wide receivers, red zone matchup specific times when he plays more 1 week versus other weeks. But yeah, I think that would be a really fun group. And you always come back to with the Patriots offense that you want to work the middle of the field ultimately. Well, if you have Aguilar and you have Thornton over the top, that makes so much more room for Bourne, for Meyers, for Henry, even for Jonnu Smith, the backs out of the backfield. Like, they're going to have one-on-one matchups underneath. They're going to have leverage. They're going to have a lot of room to work with. And that's, I think, what they're ultimately going to look for by keeping all those guys on the roster. It just seems to me like they're probably at the very least going to carry 6 receivers. I would think that's sort of the number that they usually go with. And yeah. Aguilar, we know N'Keal Harry is probably not going to be here. It probably is one step too far to think that Aguilar is not going to be here at this point. I think that he's probably on the team.
I think that, well, so probably, yes. But if we're talking about roster lock, I think that if Thornton has a massive camp,
And
Devontae Parker looks great, then they would move on from him. I don't think it's likely he misses. He's as close to a roster lock as you can be without being a roster lock. Like, if we're listing them, I'd put him at the top of my non-locks list, but he's not a roster lock to me.
Okay, so let's move on from Aguilar. We talked a little bit there about Parker and Thornton, who are obviously going to be there. What out of the rest of this group, and I put De'Aaron King with the quarterbacks because that's what the team technically announced him as yesterday, but I think we know that he's probably going to work out a little bit with the wide receivers as well. Is anybody on that list, N'Keal Harry aside, Malcolm Perry, Christian Wilkerson, Trey Nixon, De'Aaron King, which one of those guys do you think has the best chance to stick as the 6th receiver if they do carry 6 guys?
I think Christian Wilkerson, just because what he gives them on special teams. Yeah. We saw it last year in training camp and in the preseason. He's a coverage guy. He can play gunner. He can go down the field. He can cover kicks. De'Aaron King's really interesting. I think he's still a year away. I think he can contribute as a wide receiver in the NFL. I really do believe that. I just think he needs a year to kind of, you know, he was a wide receiver for the first 2 years of his college career, and then he's been playing quarterback since. So he's not truly developed there yet. I think he's a guy that ends up on the practice squad. And then this time next year, especially if Jakobi Meyers leaves in free agency, right, which we think is going to happen, we're talking a lot about De'Aaron King as a potential slot receiver, and that's a storyline to watch. But I'm not there with him just yet. I would put him in the wide receiver category. Again, I know they list him as a quarterback. It's going to be really interesting to see what color jersey he's wearing on the first day of OTAs. Yeah. But, yeah, I would I still think he's a year away. I'd go with Wilkerson.
I'm with you on Wilkerson. I think he's easily got the best chance out of that group to make it. You mentioned the special teams value. They're going to look at those last couple of games at the end of the regular season too and think there was good things. Certainly that Jacksonville game, there was definitely good things out of him. And if you're looking at him as a reserve guy that can play inside, outside, and play in the kicking game for you, if you want to activate him on game day, those are enough roles and enough boxes checked, I think, that he makes the roster. And he's one of those guys too that's had really good training camps over the last couple of years. He's been really strong in the summertime, and he's really made a push for the roster. So I think that he ends up making it.
I want to take a second to shout out our friends at betonline.ag. Our partners at BetOnline continue to be the number one source for all your betting needs and sports info. Find all the latest sports developments, including updated odds on the playoffs, fights, and even next season's futures. BetOnline is your continued source for all your sports wagering needs, including live betting and your favorite Vegas casino and poker games. It's super easy to get started, so head to the website today or use your mobile device to join and use our promo code CLNS50 to receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. BetOnline, where the game starts.
Last thing here on the wide receivers, N'Keal Harry. Well, let's just put this out there and be honest. If the Patriots had a trade partner for N'Keal Harry, he'd already be off the team, right? I mean, this is not a matter of the Patriots hanging on for hope that N'Keal Harry is going to prove out to be a good player or live up to that first round expectation. There is nobody that wants to give the Patriots anything for N'Keal Harry. So what do you think ultimately ends up happening with him? Do you think that they cut him? Do you think that they find a trade partner at the end of training camp? Or maybe they end up keeping him for one more year. He is under contract for one more season, and then you can cut bait next offseason.
There's value in bringing him into camp. He can only increase his trade value. We talked about this on a previous show, right? Let him go out there. Let him moss Juwan Williams a couple of times. Let him do it in a preseason game. Get the hype up. Maybe you can move him in a pick swap. They just have too many wide receivers. It's not worth the roster spot for them to keep him, right? And everybody's go, oh, play tight end. He's not a tight end. That would make it easy. If he was a tight end, that would make it easy. Because I'd rather have him probably than Asiasi or Keen.
Right.
But he's not that guy. So they might end up having to cut him. There's some dead money. There's not a ton. But I can't see him on the team.
Yeah. I mean, I think what you're hoping for is that maybe somebody gets hurt in another camp. Obviously, you're not hoping anybody gets hurt. But that's the idea is somebody gets hurt in another camp. A team has a few injuries at the wide receiver position. They absolutely just need a body there. Maybe N'Keal Harry becomes somebody that can fill in there. But at this point during the draft, they basically got no calls on him. I would say it's a really similar situation to what's going on with Andy Isabella at Arizona. Those guys just have no value around the league. Nobody wants them. If they do want them, it's after they're cut and they restart their contracts, and it's basically nothing on guarantees that they're offering the player. Nobody wants to pick up N'Keal Harry's fourth year. It's just that simple, and the Patriots have had basically no traction whatsoever with the trade on that one. Let's move over to the quarterbacks and get into some of these discussions here. I think the interesting place to start is certainly Bailey Zappe versus Jarrett Stidham. Right now, I find it really hard to believe the Patriots drafted Zappe in the fourth round, 137 overall. They clearly like the kid. They seem to have almost targeted him at that point in the draft, or at least added those extra fourth rounders to be able to take a stab at a quarterback. This spells the end to me for Jarrett Stidham easily. The question is are you willing to go as far to have Bailey Zappe as a roster lock? And does he eventually push Brian Hoyer out? Or how far do you think this could go for Zappe and how quickly?
So I need to look something up real quick here. Kevin O'Connell, they drafted in the third round. Granted, this is in 2008.
Yeah.
But they drafted him in the third round.
Yes.
And then released him. So it's not it wouldn't be unprecedented if Zappe didn't make the team. That being said, Stidham's not the guy. I think that's been made clear at this point. They need a backup. I think Hoyer's more of a coach, a high-paid coach, than he is anything else. I think Zappe would be the second-dressed, you know, quarterback on game days. I would call Zappe a lock. I would be thoroughly, thoroughly shocked if they cut him. To go back to my rule, if somebody said, should I buy a Bailey Zappe jersey, I might say wait to find out what number he has. But, yeah, pre-order it. Go ahead. So, yes, I would consider him a roster lock.
Yeah, I would consider him a roster lock also. I think they really like this kid, not only just in the fact that he can be that high-end backup, that Brian Hoyer long-term, but I think that they almost look at him as a real insurance policy for what ends up happening with Mac Jones and his development. Yeah. Not even just necessarily about this year, next year, whatever. But once we get into Mac Jones year 5 year six, and they have to think about paying him, are they going to want to pay him at that point, the top of the quarterback market, 30, 35, 40 million, whatever it ends up being? We heard Matt Groh talk about it after the draft when they drafted Zappe, that they're taking a college-like approach to that quarterback position where they want to have somebody in the pipeline at all times. Even if they love their starter, they always want to have somebody in the pipeline. To me, Zappe is right now their guy in the pipeline, and I just don't see them going anywhere with him unless he looks completely overwhelmed by NFL football when he is here in the spring and the summer, which I don't think is going to be the case. So I have a tough time not calling Bailey Zappe a lock. Mentioned Brian Hoyer a couple times, and
I'll just say this too. You mentioned Groh talking about the college process at quarterback, just because I know there's a lot of people who aren't college football fans who watch this show who might think, what does that mean? Look at what Ohio State's doing right now. Ohio State's obviously, for the most part, a successful program. They haven't quite gotten over the hump as much as Alabama, but they have on their roster right now the projected number one pick in the draft next year, and CJ Stroud is their starting quarterback. Behind him, they just landed a guy named Quinn Ewers as a transfer. Quinn Ewers is a transfer. He was the number one high school recruit in the country 2 years ago. He's supposedly the best quarterback prospect since Trevor Lawrence. He is going to back up CJ Stroud. And then just yesterday, they added the number one quarterback recruit in the 2023 class. This is what colleges do, because you never know if somebody gets hurt. You know, somebody could transfer, which the NFL equivalent would be not being able to work out the contract. The idea is that you have all this talent around the quarterback. If the quarterback position somehow gets messed up, you can't afford that, because you lose your shot and you don't know how many shots you're going to get at it. Because the quarterback position is more expensive in the NFL, teams don't necessarily do that, but that's what it looks like. Oh yeah, sorry. You were transferred to Texas, but they had at one point all of those guys. So that's what the quarterback thing means. And if you can get them at cost, right, with draft picks, then it would be able to do that. They would be able to do that.
Yep. And so I think that that's really what they're thinking as well. And that's a good explanation of what the college system is let's just get as much talent at the most important position as we possibly can, and then figure it out from there. Obviously, Mac's a starter. He's a long-term answer. He's not going anywhere anytime soon. But unless they can find a way to get him under contract in year three, I think is when you're technically eligible to sign an extension as a rookie on a rookie contract, then he's going to break the bank, right? If he gets into free agency year six, he's going to break the bank. Mentioned Brian Hoyer a couple times. I know there's a lot of calls for him to be a coach. I know in the past that we were talking off the air about how the Patriots have released Brian Hoyer. He doesn't have to go through waivers as a veteran, and they know he's not going anywhere. And he ends up signing back with the practice squad for a week or two until they can open up a roster spot, and they sign him to the 53. There's certainly that. You can go that route with it, right? Brian Hoyer could definitely be cut, brought back on the practice squad, and then put on the 53 when the time comes. I think that's kind of a technicality sort of way to do this. Brian Hoyer is going to be in Foxborough this season. He's going to be a Patriot this season one way or another. So I don't necessarily think that that discussion is really to be had. But the whole coaching thing, though, I think that people don't realize, first of all, number one, how much of a pay cut that is to go from backup quarterback player to coach is definitely something that is a huge pay cut.
Tenfold. Yeah.
It's also something that is a huge time commitment to go from a player to a coach. Coaches, I don't think people realize sometimes how much coaches work, especially assistant coaches that are grinding tape and padding and coming up with all these game plans and things like that and scouting opponents. They're there 24/7 around the clock, especially during the season. So that's quite the time commitment for somebody like Brian Hoyer too. So he's got the best of both worlds. He's got the paycheck and he's got the player schedule to throw that all away to be a coach. I think that they're literally going to have to tell him, and I mean all 32 teams are literally going to have to tell Brian Hoyer, there is no place for you on an NFL roster anymore before we get to the point where he's thinking about coaching.
And at the same time for the Patriots, there's then limitations on how much time Brian Hoyer can spend with Mac Jones working with him that don't exist when they're teammates. So outside of the roster spot is the only reason that the that it would incentivize the Patriots to make Brian Hoyer a coach. And there is no reason for Brian Hoyer to want to be a coach if the team will still have him as a player. There's none. So there's also, I mean, on top of everything you said, he might have already hit the top threshold. He might be another year or two in terms of pension, you know, years in the league tied into that, what he can get in terms of health insurance after he retires. He's not just going to be like, yeah, I'll be a coach. That's fine. Like that's not how anything works.
Yeah, absolutely. So Jared Stidham in a very similar position as N'Keal Harry, honestly, in terms of he's got no trade value. He's probably got very little value on the roster, but it wouldn't completely shock me if they carry all four guys. I think that they might see
that would shock me. There.
It would surprise me.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's really tough to do it numbers-wise, so I hear you. Well, but what is Stidham doing
at that point?
Yeah.
What's the benefit? What is Stidham giving you that
I guess that I go back to the 2001 Patriots quarterback room, and obviously Drew Bledsoe was on that team, and Brady.
So
2002, you have, you know, they've had numbers.
So back then.
On there, right?
Back then, you were able to carry an extra quarterback that didn't count against your roster total.
Okay, that's a fair point.
So if Jared Stidham didn't count against the roster, I'm sure they'd love to keep him.
Yeah.
But he does. So
yeah. So what do you think ends up happening with Stidham? You think it's just an outright cut at that point then?
I mean, if they can move him, I think they would. You know, we've seen this in the past that a quarterback's tied with the Patriots. And look, he was in the room with Brady for a year. You know, some team may see some value in that and say, hey, you know, Stidham in a seventh for a future seventh, whatever, something like that, right? Some team may want to jump to the front of the line with him, but they're not going to get anything of serious value. What I think they will do is they'll showcase him. And we've seen them do this in the past, that, and it's one less preseason game now, so maybe it's a little bit tougher, but I wouldn't be surprised if he gets that whole third preseason game, right? If we see a significant amount of Jared Stidham, I don't think Mac Jones is going to play much this preseason. I don't think Brian Hoyer is going to play much this preseason. I think it would be Bailey Zappe to get him acclimated and Jared Stidham to showcase him.
So we could do the old Jacoby Brissett, right?
They did it with Brissett. They tried to do it with Danny Etling. It didn't work, even though he had a monster touchdown run.
Yeah.
They did it with Hoyer. They even did it with Hoyer one of the times before they cut him. But yeah, I just don't think they can. I think they'll try to move him, but they're not going to keep Stidham. Like, I could see them maybe. Let's say there's an injury. Maybe N'Keal Harry sticks around for the beginning of the season. Like, maybe.
Right.
That would surprise me less than if they kept Stidham.
All right, let's move on to running backs. I think the first four names on this list, everybody assumes is a lock. The one thing that I want to talk to you about is James White. I think this one stinks. It's fair to say it stinks for all of us that there's a chance, a very real chance that James White, I would say that the more real chance of him getting cut is that he starts the year on PUP. I don't think that they're going to outright cut him. The question really is he going to be healthy enough to play week one or even be on the 53 week one? I could see him making the roster initially and then going on injured reserve after the fact, that they want to take that approach if they do try to ramp it up in training camp and see what he's got. But I think that there's a really good chance that he actually starts the regular season, not just training camp, but the regular season on the PUP list, which would put him out until week seven of the regular season in the NFL. Those are the rules. So I think James White's going to be around. He's going to be on the roster one way or another. It might be reserve roster like PUP or IR, but I think he's going to be around. The question more is, do we think that there's a chance that James White can be the same guy that he was pre-hip injury? He's aging. That's a brutal injury. It's a brutal rehab. He spoke about it a couple of months ago, and it sucks to say, but there's a chance that this is not going to be the same player.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. I don't think they cut him. I do think that there's the reports right now are he's going to miss at least the start of spring practices, probably all of spring practices. When can they get him going over the summer? I would agree with you. I think the best case scenario is he gets put on IR. Although I think they're limiting which IR rules did they change? Because they changed a bunch of them, right?
I believe the IR rules are now back to normal, as in it's not 3 weeks anymore on injured reserve. It's the pre-COVID IR rules, right? So I don't think the COVID IR rules are still in effect. I think you still have...
Well, how many returns do you... Like, that's ultimately the question.
I think it's still unlimited for the returns. Like, I could be wrong about that, but I don't think... Remember the last couple of years with COVID, you could put guys on IR for 3 weeks and then bring them back. Now, right. I think it's back to that half a season that they have to be out, 8 games, and then you can bring them back. But I do think that they still allow an unlimited amount. But I
no, here it is. No more unlimited returns from injured reserve. So 6 weeks, no unlimited return. I believe it's 2. It was or 1 at one point. I think just before COVID, right, they increased it to 2. So I guess there's nobody else that really projects as a, you know, we'll see. Guys get hurt during camp. Guys get hurt in the preseason, right? But you got to be more careful with those spots. You probably want to save one. It's going to be a tricky one. It's going to be a tricky one to see how they keep James White in the fold. I think they will keep him in the fold, but it's going to be tricky.
So if James White, whether he is or isn't,
and by the way, they should bring back unlimited returns. I'm fine with them increasing it from 3 weeks to 6. 3 weeks felt a little short. What they should do is like baseball does. Baseball has they have the 15 and the 60, right? Day DL, IL, which are like the standard. They also have a 10-day IL that's, I think, just for concussions. I would like to see they should do a 3-week concussion IR. So guys aren't rushing back from concussions. Everything else is 6 weeks, right? And they should have unlimited return from both. That's just how I would do it.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think the unlimited return was a really great rule, not only for teams, but also for players, because it just got guys back quicker and allowed guys to play that deserve the chance to play, right? Now you get stacked on injured reserve, you're out for the year, it gets tricky. So those four running backs are going to be in the building. They're going to be in the fold. Whether James White's able to contribute or not is yet to be seen. I still think that they keep at least 5 of these names on this list, though. So that leaves that last spot for Montgomery, Taylor, or Kevin Harris. Montgomery and Taylor are obviously very different backs from Kevin Harris. Those guys are passing downs backs. Those are pass catching backs. Montgomery has that chance to contribute on special teams as well that they might like in terms of kick coverage specialist. I don't know if he's going to be returning any kicks for them, but he's going to be able to contribute by covering kicks. So I do think that helps him out a lot. And maybe they look at Montgomery as a 1-for-1 for Brandon Bolden more so than a guy like J.J. Taylor. So if James White is able to give them something, I actually think that it's Montgomery who ends up making the roster as the 5th back. If James White is on PUP, on injured reserve, you know, not doing well, then I do think that that opens the door a little bit more up for J.J. Taylor. But I think that Ty Montgomery right now has the inside track.
I still don't know. Taylor's biggest issue is still pass blocking, which I don't think is going to get better. It's a size thing.
Right.
I wouldn't be surprised if they had another back here at some point. And these guys don't always make the team, but we've seen them add backs during camp. Who was it they added in 2020? Was Lamar Miller, right? Yeah. I still think there's a chance another back comes in. I really do. I still don't think this is enough. If James White is going to play, they don't have enough at the position. They don't. So I still think that position's in flux. Like you said, they still have 3 roster spots to play with. We're in the second phase of free agency. I think there's another move there.
It'll be interesting to see because there's been a lot of positive buzz about J.J. Taylor. He's put on some weight. He's put on some muscle. He's not going to grow taller, right? He's as tall as he is ever going to be. But he has tried to thicken out a little bit this offseason. He's been down there with all these throwing sessions. He was there with Mac Jones in the group down there in Florida last month, and he's been at OTAs or the workouts that they're doing right now, not OTAs. So I think J.J. Taylor is doing all the right things. I just don't know if he's ever going to be able to overcome some of the limitations that he has physically. If the Patriots do cut him, though, I think he's going to find a home someplace else. I don't think that this is going to be a situation where they're going to be able to stash J.J. Taylor on the practice squad. I think he's shown enough when he's gotten the opportunity to get out there that both in preseason and in the regular season when they've given him some carries, that he's got some juice and that he can play. So I'd be hard-pressed to think that they're going to be able to just keep J.J. Taylor on the practice squad or stash him or something like that and have him as depth. Maybe I could be wrong there. But they obviously see something in Kevin Harris, too. I wonder, he had the back injury in college this past season, and maybe he's another PUP candidate or injured reserve candidate. They probably don't necessarily need him with Harris and Ramondre. They probably don't need him this year, right? If they're going to need depth somewhere at running back, it's probably going to be more in a pass catching change of pace style, not necessarily a guy that's going to be between the tackles with that two-headed monster at the top of this list. But do you see Kevin Harris pushing for the roster, or how do you kind of see his rookie season shaking out?
Yeah, I think he's a redshirt guy. He's still coming off that back injury. They've got a couple of early down backs in Damien Harris and Ramondre Stevenson. I think he's a 2023 guy, unless I talked about the need for a pass catcher. Both Damien Harris and Ramondre Stevenson were good passing backs in college. Now, Patriots don't really use either of them like that. They definitely don't use Damien Harris like that. They flirted with it a little bit last year with Stevenson. If they expand one of those guys into more of a utility role, I could see maybe Kevin Harris stinks on the back end as like a goal line back. But I think that just if they were going to use Damien Harris to catch passes, I think they would have done it already. Right. So yeah, I'm not counting on that.
Ramondre Stevenson talked about that, I want to say at the end of last year, that this offseason and into year two, he was hoping to expand his game as a pass catcher. I think Ramondre Stevenson feels like he can be a really good pass catching back in the league. He showed some real flashes of that. They don't run a lot of guys up the seam from out of the backfield too often in that McDaniels offense. And they allowed Ramondre to do it a couple times, and he made some big plays happen doing that. So I think that he's got some ability as a receiver. He's not going to be James White, but just on first and second down to be able to add that, I think is going to be really interesting. I'm looking forward to seeing him run better routes, be able to catch the football. I think he's gotten more of that in his game than maybe they allowed him to let on as a rookie, just because they didn't want to put him in such a high stress situation. We know how much the Patriots emphasize pass blocking out of that running back position, option routes. It's a very difficult thing to do. It's much easier to say to the back, here's the hole, run through it, right? You know, in terms of being a ball carrier than it is to be a receiver. So I think we could see some more flashes out of that with Ramondre. And obviously Pierre Strong is everybody at this point, I think, has come to the conclusion when you talk to people around the league and when you read other people's work and stuff like that on this draft class, that Pierre Strong is here to develop into that James White role, or maybe be a little bit more like Rex Burkhead was, where he can do a little bit of everything. And but I think that he's not here to be the bell cow, right?
He's here to factor in on passing downs. He's here to be a factor on passing downs.
Absolutely. All right. Tight ends. Only four tight ends right now on the Patriots roster, which is pretty hard to believe, but that's where we're at based off of all the moves and the it's just hard to believe because they've had, even if they haven't been good bodies, they've had bodies at that spot for the last couple of years, right? Guys like Matt Lacoste, Troy Fumagalli is a free agent still. You know, they've had some guys in and out at that
position. Did Matt Lacoste sign anywhere?
He's not on the Patriots roster. I don't know if he's signed anyplace else.
He's a free agent. I could see them bringing him back. This is another spot where, like, I could see them adding somebody before camp. Remember last year, OTAs, they were signing guys, like, into OTAs every morning we got out there and there was a new player at practice.
Yeah.
Running back and tight end are both spots. I could see them doing that.
Yeah, tight end definitely is a little bit thin, especially when you start to think about, it was great that Hunter Henry was able to play a whole year last year, but there's obviously injury history there. Johnny Smith had some injuries last year, got banged up a little bit. And at this point, Asiasi and Keen look like sunken costs, right? I mean, I don't know what you're getting out of that group. But before we get into Asiasi and Keen and their outlook for this year, I think we already know what Hunter Henry brings to the table. He's a solid, reliable guy. really good player for them last year. I think the guy that we saw last year is Hunter Henry. Like that's what he brings to the table, and it's right. a really valuable player to have on your roster. How about Jonnu Smith? We heard about Robert Kraft at the owners' meetings. He mentioned that the Patriots are making some tweaks. They want to see more out of a guy like Jonnu Smith. What do you project that they do to get more out of Jonnu? Because he's in the yellow. He's a lock, and he's not going anywhere on that contract. So you're at least stuck with Jonnu Smith, for lack of a better phrase, for two more seasons, I would say, because that contract is basically all guaranteed until he hits that fourth year.
Well, I think what's encouraging is, and Nelson Agholor talked about how year two can be a great jump year for guys in the Patriots system, and there is some truth to that, right? I think if you look at, let's try to piece this together. And this goes back to a conversation we were having earlier, right? I think there's a chance that this offense looks a little different than it did last year. I think there's a shot that it looks different than it has traditionally under Bill Belichick. Let's, and again, I'm just projecting here. Like this is real big picture, bird's eye view, 1,000 feet, whatever. But we talked about maybe going with that more vertical speed element to match Alabama. Right, where you have Tyquan Thornton, you have Nelson Agholor, and then Parker or Bourne, and those are your three main receivers. You're coming out of 11 personnel, and you're running those guys up the field. In that offense, you still need an outlet, right? You still need that check down option. Traditionally, that's the running back. But we just talked about how James White might not be healthy. Pierre Strong's a rookie. We don't know if they're going to use Ramondre that way. If we're going to model this instead after the Alabama offense, Alabama has had a guy. He transferred to Texas, Jahleel Billingsley, who will be my favorite tight end in the draft next year. Spoiler alert. Jahleel Billingsley profiles very similarly to Jonnu Smith, where he's kind of this hybrid tight end running back receiver who's just really good with the ball in his hands. And what they would do a lot is just run him on drags or shallow in routes. And that was the check down. It might have been 5 yards downfield, but that was the check down. So let's apply this. Now, if you really want to have this Alabama influence on the offense, and again, we haven't even had one spring practice yet, and I'm putting the depth chart together and putting the starting offense together, but we're doing it for fun. We're having the exercise. Thornton, Agholor, Bourne, Park, your three receivers, those guys running down the field, and then Jonnu Smith just coming underneath when they clear everything out, and you're throwing him checkdowns, you're throwing him crossers, you're throwing him in cuts, and you're getting him in space with the ball in his hands. If that's the way they're going to set it up, and it kind of looks like it's going in that direction, the fact they didn't add that definitive experience pass catching back, that role as it's traditionally existed in New England, that role, ultimately the guy who's going to catch the ball around the line of scrimmage and make things happen with the ball in his hands. You need that guy in the offense. Absolutely. Any offense needs that guy. Traditionally in New England, that's been a running back. It's not, I know people think, well, what about Julian Edelman? It's a little different. Right. He's not necessarily catching the ball at the line. They're getting him open 5 to 8 yards downfield. And then he's going from there. And that's the role Myers is in now. James White has been the guy at the line of scrimmage. That role still needs to be filled. It doesn't have to be filled by a running back. You could have Jonnu Smith, again, just running flat along the line of scrimmage, running 1 or 2 yards down the field, and then getting him the ball in motion in space. Like that, to me, I'd love to see that with Jonnu Smith this year. You have all the speed now on offense. You really have an opportunity, I think, more than last year to keep defenses honest and keep them back up the field, right? Or keep them back down the field. I think Jonnu Smith could eat underneath if they give him that opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the way to really make it in simplest terms, when you design an offense,
clean that up. That was a mess.
When you're designing offense, you're thinking it's always touchdown, first down, check down, right? Those are the three like levels of the offense that you're thinking. Hunter Henry, Myers, Bourne, those are your first down guys, right? Those are the guys that are going to run a lot of routes in that 8 to 12 intermediate range. Then you have your touchdown guys. Those are Tyquan Thornton and Nelson Agholor, Devontae Parker, the guys that are going to go over the top. Then you need to have that check down layer. And every single good offense, and I see this a lot of times in college, and it drives me nuts. Now, sometimes in college, the quarterbacks are athletic, or at least they're athletic for that level. So they're kind of their own check down, right? If there's nobody there, they just let the quarterbacks take off. But a lot of times when they design offenses in college, what drives me, or what makes me kind of think, that's holding these quarterbacks back at times, is they don't design checkdowns into the offense, right? Everybody is 20 plus yards down the field by the time the quarterback's ready to make a decision. And then at that point, it's basically on the quarterback to be an athlete and be his own check down. The Patriots certainly are not going to design it that way. They've always had that check down. And when you look at Jonnu Smith, you mentioned some of the things that they might have him run, but those flares into the flats, the drag routes underneath the defense, these little routes over the middle of the field, over the ball, that just, here I am, right? And especially right. If they can get him in motion or moving when he catches the football versus stagnant and just catching it from a standstill, then he can really be somebody that can turn upfield and make things happen and get him into space and make it work that way. So when you look at his skill set in general, this is just not a guy that wins at the top of the route. He's not somebody that's going to break it down and run a great route break and get open and create all this separation with his technique. He is an athlete. You want to get him the football in the hands, or the football in his hands. And I think right. That's a great role for him. It's not going to be the James White role. It's not going to be option routes out of the backfield. He's not going to get up to the top of the route and have a three-way go and make a move and make a decision. It's going to be little drags, little flares, little arrow routes into the flats. And when Mac Jones goes through his progression, which usually is first down, touchdown, then check down, they kind of do it in inverse. Once he goes through that progression, it's going to be, all right, nobody's open down the field. Here's Jonnu in the flat. Let's give him the football and see if he can make a guy miss. It's right. Really not the worst way to go about it. And for Jonnu, that could be a role that might actually see him targeted a whole lot more, right? I mean, yeah. When you're in that check down role, that can potentially be an 80 target season for Jonnu Smith in that kind of role. I think that that's the best way to use him in this offense, especially now with that speed. You can also incorporate some screens in there. You have Tyquan Thornton and Nelson Agholor getting up the field, and then all of a sudden they leak Jonnu out and they get the offensive line out and it's a screen to the tight end. I think those elements of this offense would really behoove Jonnu and get the most out of him. So I would imagine that's what they're talking about at Gillette now or something along those lines. I think you nailed it, that he's going to be more of that guy that's going to operate closer to the line of scrimmage and be kind of a check down guy for Mac Jones and let him create with the football.
Yeah. And I don't think it's a bad role. Like I said this last year, I thought they were going to turn Jonnu into a volume catch guy. And that yeah. might ultimately be his best role. I know people are going to roll their eyes at me saying that, like, why do you want him to be a volume guy after the way he played last year? It goes back to the scheme touch guys. They just haven't figured out. They haven't been able to use those guys. A lot of Jonnu's struggles last year was he was simply being asked to do things he's never done before, and things, frankly, aren't in his skill set. That needs to change. And maybe I'm banging my head against the wall here. I said that about N'Keal Harry for 3 years, that they're not using him right. They never fixed it. But the circumstances are different now. Again, I think they need that role filled. I think Jonnu Smith is like a 5 to 10 target a game guy around the line of scrimmage and just let him run with the ball. I think that's the best role for him. I think they get their money's worth out of that.
Absolutely. All right. Third tight end here. They're probably going to carry three. Maybe not. If they feel like neither one of these guys is even worth carrying on the roster, then they might not necessarily feel the need to carry three. But you would think traditionally that they would carry three. Out of Asiasi and Keen, I think it's easier to have more hope about Asiasi just because we've seen it, right? But I think right. the idea of Keen in that role is still interesting to me. If they can get him into that Juszczyk type of mold, but he just has dealt with so many injuries and he's never been healthy and they've never really been able to get him off the runway, even necessarily get him all the way to the vacation spot. They haven't even gotten him off the runway at this point. So out of those two guys, I guess who's the one that gives you the most hope, or who's the one that you would like to see emerge as a third tight end on this depth chart?
Yeah, I feel bad for Keen. He's had the neck injury, right?
That injury, I don't even know. I mean, like, I don't even know, right? That injury could be severe.
It seems like he's had serious injuries. It would be nice if they could keep him because they don't have a true fullback on the roster right now. He could maybe do some of that stuff, so that would be interesting. Like you mentioned, we've seen it with Asiasi. I think one of them ultimately emerges during camp and during the preseason, but, boy, I'd really like to see another tight end emerge, whether it's somebody, if they bring Matt Lacoste, like I'd feel better about Matt Lacoste if they brought him back.
Yeah.
I'd feel better about Troy Fumagalli if they brought him back. I'll give you a UDFA that still hasn't signed. That's Jordan Myers out of Rice. We're talking about, you know, kind of some of the things they need. I wrote a little bit about Jordan Myers before the draft. Jordan Myers is listed as a wide receiver. He's like 6'2", 225. He was listed as a wide receiver tight end hybrid on Rice's roster, but he carried the ball 200 times last year and caught 110 passes. So he lines up everywhere. He does everything. You talk about the need for a third tight end. You talk about the need for a pass catching back. You talk about the need for maybe another power back. They used him a lot out of the backfield on the goal line. Go get me that guy. And there's other guys in the NFL that can do it. Like, I'd like to see them add a hybrid tight end running back to fill that third role. I guess that makes my answer keen because he's more that guy. I just don't think he's healthy. This is something where I think that the third tight end, if they do keep one, isn't on the roster right now. And again, if you wanted to Google him, Jordan Myers, he doesn't spell it like Jacoby. There's no first E. Jordan Myers at a Rice would be the guy I'd look at. I think last time I checked was yesterday. He hasn't signed. So unless somebody signed him today, which they have not, I think the Patriots should sign him.
So just to play devil's advocate here with the tight ends, the one thing I would say, though, is that if Hunter Henry were to go down, then they really don't have a traditional inline tight end.
Oh, you need a third.
Right. That's so true. Devin Asiasi is definitely more in that mold, right, of a guy that can play with his hand in the dirt, play next to the tackle at the end of the line, and be that traditional inline tight end. But I also think when I look at the team in general, I look at wide receiver. They're definitely going to have Devontae Parker on the roster. There's an outside chance that N'Keal Harry is still here for year four. They're going to have good depth at that position, barring any serious injury bug going through that room. If Hunter Henry were to go down, they might just look at it and say, we're just going to kind of play Parker or play Harry as kind of a jumbo wide receiver, maybe closer to the formation, and basically run four wide receivers out there, right? Especially in passing situations. So I don't necessarily know if they actually care about their depth a ton at tight end, just because I think that they feel like they have those bigger receivers at the wide receiver position that if Hunter Henry or if Jonnu Smith were to go down, that they would have that ability to move a guy like Devontae Parker, 6'3", 215 pounds, into more of a blocking role inside the formation or closer to the inside the tackles, right? In line position. So that's the way that I think that they look at that, at least as of right now, because they haven't added anybody. They haven't signed a UDFA. They haven't signed a free agent at tight end. They've done absolutely nothing at tight end. Absolutely nothing. Right. So they obviously feel good about Hunter Henry and Jonnu Smith, but I think on the depth behind it, it might speak more to the fact that they have those bigger receivers in Parker and Harry on the roster. You want to talk about this monster offensive line group right now?
They've got depth. Guys,
16 guys on the roster.
What percent of the roster is that? That is 18% of the roster.
18% of the roster is the big boys.
Well, of the 90, man. So it's probably closer to 20 because they don't have the full 90 guys.
Yeah, they only have 87. So 16 of their 87 players on the roster right now are offensive linemen.
18.5%.
Yeah, they usually carry 10, maybe 9 some years, but 9 or 10 is right around the range that they like to keep it at. I think some of these guys certainly have some practice squad value or potential that they could sneak them through to the practice squad. Cole Strange right at the top of the list, obviously not going anywhere. Isaiah Wynn, I think, was the one out of that yellow group that I hesitated with, but I just think that they haven't added enough. They didn't draft a tackle in the first round. They didn't trade or sign a veteran tackle. I find it hard to believe that Isaiah wins anywhere but New England in the fall, because they really don't have any other options for this year, at least, unless they want to get tricky with it, move Trent Brown back to left tackle, move Onwenu to right tackle, and then play somebody else inside, right, other than Onwenu. I guess they could go that direction, but I think that they would like to keep Trent Brown on the right side, and I think wins on this team. I just think that they think they get one more year out of him here.
Yeah, I mean, they would have to get a pretty significant trade package. They don't have an immediate replacement for him. And I know I talked about Cole Strange maybe playing some left tackle. I don't think in year one. So if they had taken, you know, well, Trevor Penning was off the board, but if they'd taken a guy like Bernard Raymond, Tyler Smith, whoever, it becomes more of a conversation. But they need Isaiah Wynn. They don't have another starting left tackle on the roster. He has to be here.
I think Isaiah Wynn's going to be fine for them next year too. Last year, really the biggest problem that he had was penalties. You get his technique back to where it needs to be with the penalties and get his focus up a little bit more than where it was last year. I don't really think that he was a bad player on the whole for the Patriots last season. I know that a lot of people rag on Isaiah Wynn, and I'm not saying that he's a long-term answer at left tackle. I'm not giving him an extension or anything like that. But for one more year, until they figure out where they're going to go at that position, make sure, you know, try to limit the penalties, try to shrink down on some of those penalties that he had last year that killed them, and move forward with Isaiah Wynn for one more year. I also have Justin Herron as a lock right now. Just as that third tackle, he really separates himself to me from the rest of that group that's not in yellow as the top swing tackle on the roster. And I just don't really see a way that he's not on this team as that top guy.
Yeah, I again, the tackle depth is the one thing that kind of concerns me right now. I think with Brown and Wynn, they're fine in terms of their starters, but they need Heron's their best third tackle. Normally they like to carry four. Maybe Stuber steps up as that guy. Maybe we see something from Will Sherman, who they took late last year. But I would agree with you. If Heron doesn't make the team, then they're very, very thin a tackle.
So who out of that non-yellow group? You mentioned Sherman, you mentioned Stuber. I really like Stuber a lot. I think that he's going to be a potential find for them. I love Chasen Hines too. I almost put James Ferentz in yellow. I think that he's got a really good chance at it, just based off the fact that they traded, or they parted ways, I guess is a better way to put it. Traded Shaq Mason, lost Ted Karras in free agency. I think that he's one of those guys that needs to be here as well, just as veteran backup depth. Unless they add another veteran that we talked about on Thursday, potentially them adding another veteran guard here to the mix. It seems like James Ferentz makes it, but who out of that the rest of this group, any love for Arlington Hambright or Drew Jarlay or anything here that you like?
Yeah, I mean, I really like I like Hines and Stuber. I thought they did well in the draft with those guys. I think they have a potential backup, you know, full right side, right guard, right tackle, and Stuber, and a combo guard, probably interior offensive lineman, full center, and as well in Hines. So I like that. Roussey's an interesting player as well. He's the kind of guy they like, where he, you know, multi-year starter, multi-year captain, transfer. I could see him sticking around. There'll be a strange aside. I should say, in addition to strange, I think there'll be another rookie offensive lineman on this team, at least one.
Yeah, I actually really like both the UDFA centers that they signed. I think both these guys have a chance. Roussey is a lot more in that David Andrews mold, right? Yeah. An undersized center, but really cerebral and really athletic for his size, or for a center position. He's somebody that I think does have a lot of traits that overlap with what David Andrews had coming out of Georgia. You also hear about his leadership and all that center type of jargon that you like to hear. With Liam Shanahan, though, Shanahan's bigger, right? He's 6'5". He's almost 310 pounds. He's a little bit closer to maybe what Ted Karras was coming out of college when Ted Karras was coming out. The Patriots drafted Karras in the sixth round. I think that Shanahan, he's had some play strength concerns. That's the one thing, is he's going to have to bulk up and really get a little bit more sturdy inside. But I think that he's got some more guard center versatility and could potentially back up all three spots in the future, just because of the fact that he's got that size. He's 6'4", 6'5", 310. He's certainly got guard size if they want to try to develop him a little bit at guard as well. So I like both of those guys. I think they could have potential on the roster. I think that there is also maybe a little bit of a push for Desjardins. I think they're interested to see what they have with it, right? I mean, he's a really, really good player up in Canada. One of the best offensive linemen in the CFL. Wins a couple Grey Cups.
Oh, so now we're okay. So now you want to talk about the CFL. Now they're on the offensive line. Now you're all giddy to talk about the CFL.
I'm just saying, give the guy a chance in training camp. That's all I'm saying, right? When the pads get on, let's give him a chance. He's played a lot of football, right? Some of these guys that you look at along the offensive line coming out of college, they just haven't really played a ton of football in their careers. They haven't played a ton of snaps. He's one of those guys that kind of got an extra college couple of years there up in Canada, right, to really hone in on the technique. I knew you were going to make fun of me for that one. But I like all those guys in terms of depth, and we'll see what happens in the tackle spot, though. I'm with you. That's the one thing that I look at this group. I actually think they are pretty built on the interior, obviously, with drafting a guard. In the
I think they're great on the inside. It's just a matter of what they're doing on the outside.
Yeah, I'm with you. So we'll see what ends up happening with that group. But when I put this together and I finalized this after the draft and the UDFA announcements, and I saw 16 offensive linemen that the Patriots currently have, and they only have 87 guys on the roster. So it's not even like they have a need to cut any of these guys anytime soon. So I think there's a pretty good chance that you see at least 15, if not all 16 of these guys actually make it to training camp in July. So that's a huge number. It's a big, big group. So there you have it. That's our rundown of what's going on with the Patriots offense as we sit here in the middle of May, on May 10th, right after the draft. UDFA signings announced yesterday. Like I mentioned, I know a lot of you pointed out the tab on the defensive side of the football. Tabs for next week, next Tuesday, we'll do a show recapping and going through, just like we just went through on offense, the defensive side of the football, and special teams is on that one as well. So we'll get to that in a second. But now I'm going to clear out the spreadsheet. I'm going to put the two of us on the screen because it's time. End of the show. We can't end the show with two Boston sports teams in best of three game fives in the next day, 24 hours, without the Boston Sports Minute. So here we go. Our time to get our Celtics and Bruins takes out there. Let's start with the Celtics because they played last night, and that game was one of the better and more exciting Celtics games that I've seen in a while. How could you not love what you saw from the Celtics last night, Alex? How do you feel about the Celtics last night? We can obviously pour one, a big tall one for Al Horford. We want to do that awesome as well. And what do you think about them going forward in the series?
Yeah, I love it. I think Ime Udoka, first off, got robbed for Coach of the Year. You look at some of the buttons he pushed last night. But I think this Celtics team, I think the Celtics have the Bucks figured out. I really think they do. And when they don't let the refs get in their heads, and you saw some of that mental toughness last night, they were able to shake it off later in the game, although it hurt them earlier. When they push the Bucks, when they really make the Bucks play basketball, the Bucks can't hang with them. When it's just a matter of who's more athletic, I mean, the Bucks have Giannis. He's the most athletic player in the league. He's got the size. And when they let the Bucks really set up, right? When they let the Bucks set up and do what they want to do, it's trouble. But when they run the floor, when they're moving the ball up the floor, pushing the ball up the floor, defense to offense, getting in transition, the Bucks can't stop them. You saw some of what they were doing with their ball movement. That play with Al Horford, right, all starts because they got the Bucks to overcommit to one end of the floor. Horford gets the backdoor cut. And then on the other end of the floor, it kind of feels like the opposite, right? Don't let the Bucks kind of run the floor, force them to get set up. Giannis, for whatever reason, insists on taking all these jump shots late in games, which as long as you get the rebound, which they did 50-50 last night. But, you know, if he's going to take those jump shots, let him take the jump shots, get the rebounds. That's free possessions right there. I think they've got to figure it out. Two or three left, two at the Garden. The Bucks looked really discouraged last night. That Al Horford dunk really felt like a breaking point. It really did. So it
felt like a turning point in the series. And they kind of had that Bucks defense figured out. I think the mid-range game is figuring it out, right? They want to give you threes, and they want to protect the rim. They want you to shoot threes. And I think what the Celtics have noticed is that if they pick and roll against the Bucks, then that Al Horford 12-footer is there all day long. And that's what Ime Udoka said after the game, that they got Al Horford to 30 points because they kind of figured out that the pick and pop is there because Brook Lopez is protecting the rim. He's not going to move from under the hoop. So he doesn't want Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum, Marcus Smart to get to the cup. So Al Horford is wide open there for the little pick and pop. And then late in the game, they started switching everything. And now they're getting Jason Tatum on George Hill in the mid post. And that seems to be the way they figured out this defense. I brought some stats to the Boston Sports Minute today. Because, you know, I've been texting you a lot about Giannis throughout this series. And this is not that I haven't watched Giannis play before, but when you start to watch the same player play four games in a row as it's been now, you start to really understand who he is as a player. These stats in the series for Giannis are honestly remarkable. So I pulled his shooting stats by what the NBA calls zone, but we can also call it by distance, right? How far away he is from the basket. So in the restricted area, which is 4 feet and in from the basket, where that little semicircle is where you can take a charge, he is 32 for 48 in the series with a 66.7% shooting percentage in the restricted area. Alex, can you guess what his shooting percentage is on every single other shot outside of the restricted area, of which he's taken 66?
I'm going to guess around 20%.
27%.
Yeah.
The rest of the series.
Yeah, you give him those.
Outside the restricted area, he's 2 for 16 from 3. 12.5% from 3. And I think what the most remarkable part of this stat is paint shots that are out of the restricted area, right? So that like four to I think it's what, 12 feet range or 11 feet range. He's 8 for 32. He's 25%. So I think what the most remarkable thing about Giannis is to me, and I think a lot of people are going to hear this and be like, Evan's trashing on one of the best basketball players in the league, doesn't know what he's talking about. It's actually the opposite. I think it's absolutely remarkable that he can average 32 points a game and win two MVPs and win a championship without being able to shoot a basketball. Like,
right.
The guy literally can't shoot a basketball, and he's still this unstoppable force because he can get to the hoop so easily. And it is crazy to watch how long he is and his ability to just all of a sudden, it's like he's 5 feet from the basket and he can reach out his arm and dunk the ball. It is crazy. But if you're the Celtics, I know it's a lot easier said than done, but if you keep him out of the restricted area, then you're at least going to make him work for it. You're at least going to make him earn every basket that he gets. And I think they've actually done a pretty good job. In the third quarter last night, it got away from them a little bit and he got to the hoop a bunch. But most of all in this series, or the major part of this series, they've done a really good job. And I can't even think of another comparison because he's so athletic and he's got...
There really is no comp. I'll give you another stat, though.
Yeah.
So Giannis, when guarded by any Celtic not named Al Horford in this series, 35 of 65, he's shooting about 54%. When Al Horford is guarding Giannis, he's 15 of 49. That goes down to 30%. That's in the series. That's not just last night. Horford's the answer. Horford is the answer when it comes to him.
Because
Horford is, you're not going to be more athletic or stronger than Giannis. You can't defend him athletically. You can't defend him in terms of strength. It's about footwork, technique, positioning, and basketball IQ, and just being able to pick out the angles and make the reads and all that. And that's where Al Horford excels. He's so sound technically. He knows exactly what he's doing. And I think he's been so good at not allowing Giannis to get to that point, right? He's been so good at that. So I think he's been great. And it goes to kind of what you talked about. He's not letting him get in the paint.
It is wild that a player as good as Giannis, averaging 32 points a game in the series, down his wingman, right? Doesn't have Chris Middleton, and they're still in a 2-2 series, and he's shooting 27% outside of the restricted area. It's a testament to him, and it's also the knock on him, right? And I think that the Celtics know it just as well as anybody, that you make this guy shoot the ball from more than 5 feet out of the basket, and you're going to beat him. It's really that simple. All right, moving over to the Bruins here before we wrap it up. I'm worried about the Bruins tonight, Alex. I am. You have first game without Charlie McAvoy and without Hampus Lindholm at home, backs against the wall. That's one that you get up for and you play your butt off and you get that win in game four. Now you go back to Raleigh for game five, and now you have to play another game, it seems like, without McAvoy and without Lindholm. I feel like they start to feel it at this point, right? Like, that's my concern, is that playing without their top two D pair, or their top D pair, their top two defensemen, it might not affect you in a home game, but it might affect you more when you're on the road.
I worry about the defenseman, but Carolina also looks broken. If I'm the, and I know it's hard to do this in hockey. It's hard to like single out a player to attack on offense. Like last night, right? One of the things was they started doing late in the game was just go with Grayson Allen. The Celtics, they just got Grayson Allen on switches. They attacked him downhill. I know it's harder to do that in hockey, but just go after Tony D'Angelo, man. He's so close to just snapping, like truly snapping.
He snapped at the end of the last game, and
he
I think
you're right.
The great thing about Brad Marchand is he can like do it without most of the time he doesn't snap, right? The other guy snaps first. So Brad Marchand's the perfect guy to play Tony D'Angelo with because Marchand got right under that guy's skin so quickly.
That team, it feels, and they're a front running team. They've been a front running team all year, and the Bruins have allowed too many early goals in this series. But man, just get under Tony D'Angelo's skin early. And it feels like that it just, like when D'Angelo faded, the team faded, right? It feels like that's all tied together. So go after him, pick on him. And then the other thing, they got young goalies.
Yeah.
Just pucks on net. Pucks on net. It's a volume thing. You're going to see him start squeaking through. I think that they've gotten too cute. They've gotten too particular at times in this series with the shots they want to take. When they've been at their best, they're just firing. They're just ripping shots and then capitalizing on rebounds or scrums or whatever it may be. I want to see more of that, especially without McAvoy and Lindholm back there to kind of quarterback the offense. Just let it rip. Just let it rip and see what happens. If you go down, you go down fighting, but that's what I'd like to see more of from the Bruins.
Yeah, last thing I'll say on the Bruins, Jeremy Swayman, this is one of those games where you need the goalie to steal one on the road, right? This is one of those games where the goaltending has been a big topic. Allmark started the series. Now Swayman's been hot, and they have him in net. This is one of those games that if you're going to go on a deep cup run as a team, then you need your goalie. You're down two defensemen, your top two guys, you're on the road, pivotal game five. This is the Jeremy Swayman game. If he's got the stones, this is the game where he goes out there and makes some critical saves. So you talked me off the ledge a little bit with the Bruins, but I am concerned about as you continue to move forward without McAvoy and without Lindholm, eventually those types of things tend to make a bigger impact as it wears on. One game, you might be able to get through it. Two, three games into a series, like if they don't have those guys in game six or game seven, then you start to worry a little bit more. But it does sound like McAvoy, based off of the protocol, should be able to be out by game six at the very least. So hopefully that he'll be back here soon. And we'll be back as we wrap up the Boston Sports Man. Anything else to say on the Boston? You want to talk Red Sox? You want to give a Red Sox take?
They suck so much. It's going to be great being able to go to Fenway for $10 all summer. Like, that's going to be a fun time. But holy crap, I think I said it on the last one. I don't understand how a major league team can willingly go into a season with this pitching staff. They just completely ignored.
Yeah.
It's like, you play in franchise on the show, you go through your roster to see what you need to add, you just skip the pitcher screens. Like, they needed pitchers. We all knew they needed pitchers. They didn't have enough pitchers, and they just ignored it. And now they're getting exactly what they should have gotten. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable that the Boston Red Sox would operate like that. It's a shame, is what it is.
It does feel like, too, with baseball in particular, when one part of your team, whether it's the lineup or it's the pitching staff, is deficient, it almost makes the other part of it press too much, right? And so
it's true.
Yeah. It's like when in football, if your offense is really good and your defense stinks and the offense feels like it's got to score 40 points every week to win, I feel like the Red Sox are the same way, where Devers and Bogarts and JD and all these guys should be hitting a lot better than they are, Story, but they're not because they're pressing because they know that they have to score 5 runs a game in order to be a playoff team this year. It's a psyche thing, especially in that sport. And when you're in the course of 162 games, a long, long haul, it's definitely something that I think is standing out with this team right now.
Let me add one more thing, because we've had a Raiders fan in the chat kind of bugging people all day.
And I told him to go away a couple minutes ago.
It was a fumble. And you talk about your franchise like it's some, you know, blue blood NFL chip. How does it feel that the city of Oakland didn't think you guys were worth investing in to keep around? So there you go.
Just came for the jugular there. My goodness. Just happened. You lost your team. How does
that happen? I kind of like the Raiders. I like their roster this year. I like that team. Yeah, I'm the only one who doesn't have them finishing in last in the AFC West. I'm in third. Yeah. The Chargers still have math coach, but yeah.
I actually like the Raiders too. And I actually like Josh McDaniels. As I switched the background back to Patriots, because now we're talking football again. I actually like Josh McDaniels the second time around too. Like, I actually think that he might have it figured out, and he's got Dave Ziegler upstairs with him to kind of help him out with the roster. So I think that the Raiders are in a really good spot, and I agree. I think they're going to be competitive in that division too, but we can talk about that on another show. Maybe we'll do a around the AFC, around the NFL show at some point here before the start of training camp to talk about some of these other opponents. As I mentioned on Thursday, schedule release for the entire NFL. I urge all of you to not look too much into any leaks between now and Thursday. If you see
leaks, there's already one out there.
Yeah, if you see leaks on Thursday, then those I think are legitimate. But
well, it's just who they're from. You know, NFL schedule leaks on Twitter where the Ian schedules the three. I don't know if they're from Jeff Howe, if they're from Mike Reese, if they're from Doug Hyde, if they're from us.
Yeah.
Those make a little more sense.
Fair enough. So I would hold off on any scheduling things till Thursday, but hopefully by 4 or 5 o'clock on Thursday.
What do we got? You put the other banner back up real quick.
Oh, okay. One second.
Emily Kaplan, who's ESPN's.
Oh, do we have good news about the Bruins?
This is her on Twitter. This is like a minute ago. Saw Charlie McAvoy walk into PNC Arena in Raleigh wearing an N95 mask, suggesting he cleared COVID protocols. I was told Bruins ownership arranged a private jet for him to come to Raleigh, and he's expected to take warmups. So maybe Charlie McAvoy tonight.
There so Charlie McAvoy has a chance of playing. If Charlie McAvoy plays in this game, my opinion of what I just said about the Bruins being worried about them completely changes. I think if they got McAvoy, then they got this. I would love that. That's great to hear. Emily Kaplan nailing it there by the end of the show. So McAvoy, a chance to play tonight. That's what that means. If I'm assuming if he's got his wind, right? I mean, COVID's a mother. So if you can't skate, but even if you can only play like even third line deep air minutes,
that could be big. Yeah.
Yeah. Or and he plays on special teams, you know, power play and penalty kill, then. Yeah, I love it.
We have a picture. There's now pictures. Matt Porter from, I think, The Globe.
The Globe, yeah.
It's got the picture of him walking in.
Love it. I love it.
Here we go.
Here we go. All right, so let's wrap this up. Alex and I will be back on Thursday afternoon. Like I said, we'll hold off until we have the schedule, but I think we'll have the schedule as we normally do pretty early on Thursday. So we'll recap the schedule. We'll talk about all the schedule things. This is definitely more Alex's wheelhouse. So I might have you line this one up, Alex, with all the schedule takeaways and all that kind of stuff. And we will also be back on Tuesday the following week to do the defensive side of the football.
So wait, the schedule's not until like 8 p.m. Maybe we should do Friday instead of Thursday?
Well, it's not till 8 p.m. officially, but I would be absolutely floored.
We're going to go off the reports? Okay. All right.
Yeah. Yeah. Last year, we were actually able to confirm a screenshot of the whole schedule, right? It was like thing. So I think we'll have it. So if we don't, then we'll work. We'll tinker it a little bit. And if they actually do manage to put a cap on all the leaks, we'll have to maybe do Friday. But we'll definitely do a schedule show here later on in the week. Next week, we'll do the defense side of the ball roster reset. And then we'll also look on Thursday. We'll probably do a Q&A. So we'll be back here over our next couple of weeks with the regular schedule, Tuesday, Thursday. And we'll get into OTAs at the end of the month. So there's still plenty of Patriot things to talk about. We'll also do the Boston Sports Minute until the playoff runs for the Bruins and the Celtics are over, which right now, hopefully, is not going to be for a while. So until then, signing off for Alex Barth, I'm Evan Lazar. Thanks for watching, everybody. Go Celtics, go Bruins, and we'll see you guys on Thursday.